Welcome to Dr. Creepin's Dungeon. Well, they say that death is the wish of some, the relief of many, and the end of all. Well, tonight's three stories may challenge that last part. Now, my dear friends, as ever, before we begin, a word of caution. Tonight's stories may contain strong language, as well as descriptions of violence and horrific imagery. If that sounds like your kind of thing, then let's begin. Hello, Jack. Where are you off to? Going down to the governor's place for Christmas? Jack Darrant, who was in my old regiment, stood drawing on his doeskin gloves upon the 23rd of December the year before last. He was equipped in a long ulster and top hat, and a hansom, already loaded with a gun case and portmanteau, stood awaiting him. He had a tall, strong figure, a fair, fresh-looking face, and the merriest blue eyes in the world. He had a cigarette between his lips, and late as was the season of the year, there was a flower in his buttonhole. Oh, when did I ever see handsome Jack Darrant, and he didn't look well-dressed and well-fed and jaunty. As I ran up the steps of the club, he turned round and laughed merrily. My dear fellow, do I look the sort of man to be victimized at a family Christmas meeting? Do you know the kind of business they have at home? Three maiden aunts and a bachelor uncle. My eldest brother and his insipid wife. Oh, my sister's six noisy children at dinner. Church twice a day and snapdragon between the services. No, thank you. I have a great affection for my old parents, but you don't catch me going in for that sort of national festival. You irreverent ruffian, I replied, laughing. Ah, if you were a married man. Ah, if I were a married man, replied Captain Darrant with something that was almost a sigh, and then, lowering his voice, he said hurriedly, How is Miss Lester, Fred? My sister's quite well, thank you, I answered with becoming gravity. It was not without a spice of malice that I added, Oh, she's been going to a great many balls and enjoying herself very much. Captain Darrant looked profoundly miserable. I don't see how a poor fellow in a marching regiment, a younger son too, with nothing in the future to look to, is ever to marry nowadays, he said almost savagely, when girls too are used to so much luxury and extravagance that they can't live without it. Matrimony is at a deadlock in this century, Fred, chiefly owing to the price of butcher's meat and bonnets. Oh, in 50 years' time it will become extinct and the country will be depopulated. But I must be off, old man, or I shall miss my train. You've never told me where you're going to, Jack. Oh, I'm going to stay with old Henderson in Westonshire. He's taken a furnished house with some first-rate pheasant shooting for a year. There are seven of us going, all bachelors and all kindred spirits. We shall shoot all day and smoke half the night. Oh, think what you have lost, old fellow, by becoming a Benedict. In Westonshire, is it? I inquired. Whereabouts is this place? What's the name of it? For I'm a Westonshire man by birth myself, and I know every place in the county. Oh, it's a tumble-down sort of old house, I believe, answered Jack carelessly. Gables and twisted chimneys outside, and uncomfortable spindle-leg furniture inside. You know the sort of thing. But the shooting is capital, Henderson says, and we must put up with our quarters. He's taken his French cook down, and plenty of liquor, so I've no doubt we shan't starve. Well, but what's the name of it? I persisted with a growing interest in the subject. Let me see. Referring to a letter he pulled out of his pocket. Oh, here it is. Varley Grange. Varley Grange? I repeated aghast. Why, it's not been inhabited for years. I believe not, answered Jack unconcernedly. The shooting has been let separately, but Henderson took a fancy to the house too and thought it would do for him, furniture and all, just as it is. Ah, my dear Fred, what are you looking so solemnly at me for? Jack, Let me entreat of you not to go to this place, I said, laying my hands on his arm. Not go? Why, Lester, you must be mad. Why on earth shouldn't I go there? There are stories, uncomfortable things said of that house. I hadn't the moral courage to say, it's haunted. And I felt myself how weak and childish was my attempt to deter him from his intended visits. Only, I knew all about Varley Grange. I think handsome Jack Durrant thought privately that I was slightly out of my senses, for I'm sure I looked unaccountably upset and dismayed by the mention of the name of the house that Mr. Henderson had taken. I dare say it's cold and draughty and infested with rats and mice, he said laughingly, and I have no doubt the creature comforts will not be equal to Queen's Gate. But I stand pledged to go now, and I must be off this very minute, so have no time, old fellow, to inquire into the meaning of your sensational warning. Goodbye, and remember me to the ladies. He ran down the steps and jumped into the hansom. Oh, write me if you have time, I cried out after him, but I don't think he heard me in the rattle of the departing cab. He nodded and smiled at me, and was swiftly whirled out of sight. Well, as for me, I walked slowly back to my comfortable house in Queen's Gate. There was my wife, presiding at the little 5 o'clock tea table, our two fat, pink and white little children tumbling about upon the hearthrug amongst dolls and bricks, and two utterly spoilt and overfed pugs. Oh, and my sister Bella, who, between ourselves, was the prettiest as well as the dearest girl in all London, sitting on the floor in her handsome brown velvet gown, resigning herself gracefully to be trampled upon by the dogs and to have her hair pulled by the babies. "Why, Fred, you look as if you've heard bad news," said my wife, looking up anxiously as I entered. "Well, I don't know that I've heard anything bad. I've just seen Jack Durrant off for Christmas," I said, turning instinctively towards my sister. He was a poor man and a younger son, and of course a very bad match for the beautiful Miss Lester. But for all that, I had an inkling that Bella was not quite indifferent to her brother's friend. "Oh," says that hypocrite, "shall I give you a cup of tea, Fred?" It is wonderful how women can control their faces and pretend not to care a straw when they hear the name of their lover mentioned. And I think Bella overdid it. She looked so supremely indifferent. "Where on earth do you suppose he's going to stay, Bella?" "Who? Oh, Captain Durrant. How should I possibly know where he's going? Archie, pet, please don't poke the doll's head quite down Ponto's throat. I know he'll bite it off if you do." This last observation was addressed to my son and heir. "Well, I think you'll be very surprised when you hear. He's going to Westonshire to stay at Varley Grange."
"What?"
No doubt about her interest in the subject now. Miss Lester turned as white as her collar and sprang to her feet impetuously, scattering dogs, babies, and toys in all directions away from her skirts as she rose.
"You can't mean it, Fred. Varley Grange, why, it hasn't been inhabited for 10 years. Oh, and the last time, oh, do you remember those poor people who took it? Oh, what a terrible story it has."
She shuddered. "Well, it is taken now," I said, "by a man I know called Henderson, a bachelor. He's asked down a party of men for a week's shooting, and Jack Durrant is one of them."
"For heaven's sake, prevent him from going," cried Bella, clasping her hands.
"My dear, he's gone."
"Oh, then write to him, telegraph, tell him to come back," she urged breathlessly.
"I'm afraid it's no use," I said gravely. "He would not come back. He wouldn't believe me. He would think I was mad."
"Did you tell him anything?" she asked faintly.
"No, I had not time. I did say a word or two, but he began to laugh."
"Yes, that's how it always is," she said distractedly. "People laugh and poo-poo the whole thing. Then they go there and see for themselves. And it's too late."
She was thoroughly upset when she left the room. My wife turned to me in astonishment. Not being a Westonshire woman,
She was not well up on the traditions of that venerable county. "What on earth does it all mean, Fred?" she asked me in amazement. "What's the matter with Bella? Why is she so distressed that Captain Durant is going to stay in that particular house?" "Well, it's said to be haunted and..." "Well, you don't mean to say you believe in such rubbish, Fred?" interrupted my wife sternly, with a side glance of apprehension at our firstborn, who, needless to say, stood by, all eyes and ears, drinking in every word of the conversation of his elders. "Well, I never know what to believe or what I don't believe," I answered gravely. "All I can say is that there are very singular traditions about that house, and that a great many credible witnesses have seen a very strange thing there, and that a great many disasters have happened to the persons who've seen it." "What's been seen, Fred? Pray tell me the story. Wait, I think I'll send the children away." My wife rang the bell for the nurse, and as soon as the little ones had been taken from the room, she turned to me again. "I don't believe in ghosts for any such rubbish one bit, but I should like to hear your story." "Well, the story's vague enough," I answered. "In the old days, Varley Grange belonged to the ancient family of Varley, now completely extinct. There was, some 100 years ago, a daughter, famed for her beauty and her fascination. She wanted to marry a poor, penniless squire, who loved her devotedly. Her brother, Dennis Varley, the new owner of Varley Grange, refused his consent and shut his sister up in the nunnery that used to stand outside his park gates. There are a few ruins of it left still. Oh, the poor nun broke her vows and ran away into the night with her lover. But her brother pursued her and brought her back with him. The lover escaped, but the Lord of Varley murdered his sister under his own roof, swearing that no scion of his race should live to disgrace and dishonor his ancient name. Ever since that day, Dennis Varley's spirit cannot rest in its grave. He wanders about the old house at night time, and those who have seen him are numberless. Now and then the pale, shadowy form of a nun flits across the old hall, or along the gloomy passages, and when both strange shapes are seen thus together, misfortune and illness, and even death, is sure to pursue the luckless man who's seen them with remorseless cruelty. "Oh, I wonder you believe in such rubbish," says my wife at the conclusion of my tale. I shrug my shoulders and answer nothing, for who are so obstinate as those who persist in disbelieving everything that they cannot understand? It was a little more than a week later that, walking by myself along Pall Mall one afternoon, I suddenly came upon Jack Darrant walking towards me. "Hello, Jack. Back again? Why, man, how odd you look." There was a change in the man that I was instantly aware of. His frank, careless face now looked clouded and anxious, and the merry smile was missing from his handsome countenance. "Come into the club, Fred," he said, taking me by the arm. "I have something to say to you." He drew me into a corner of the club smoking room. "You were quite right. Oh, I wish to heaven I'd never gone to that house."
"You mean,
have you seen anything?"
I inquired eagerly.
"I have seen everything," he answered with a shudder. "They say one dies within a year." "Oh, my dear fellow, don't be so upset about it," I interrupted. I was quite distressed to see how thoroughly the man had altered. "Let me tell you about it, Fred."
He drew his chair close to mine and told me his story, pretty nearly in the following words.
"You remember the day I went down? You kept me talking at the club door, and I had to race to catch the train. However, I just did it. I found the other fellows all waiting for me. There was Charlie Wells, the two Halfords, old Colonel Riddell, he's such a crack shot, two fellows in the guards, both pretty fair, a man called Thompson, a barrister, Owen Henderson, and myself. 8 of us in all. We had a remarkably lively journey down, as you may imagine, and reached Varley Grange in the highest possible spirits. And we all slept like tops that night.
The next day we were out from 11 till dusk among the coverts, and a better day's shooting I never enjoyed in the whole course of my life. The birds literally swarmed. We bagged 130 brace. We were all pretty well tired when we got home and did full justice to a very good dinner and first-class Perrier Jouet. After dinner we adjourned to the hall to smoke. Now, this hall is quite the feature of the house. It's dark and bright, panelled halfway up with sombre old oak, and vaunted with heavy carved oaken rafters. At the farther end runs a gallery, into which open the door of my bedroom, and shut off from the rest of the passages by a swing door at either end. Well, all we fellows sat up there smoking and drinking brandy and soda, and jawing, you know, as men always do when they're together, about sport of all kinds, hunting and shooting and salmon fishing. And I assure you, not one of us had a thought in our heads beyond relating some wonderful incident of a long shot or big fence, by which we could each cap the last speaker's experiences. We were just, I recollect, listening to a long story of the old colonel's about his experiences among bisons in Kashmir, when suddenly one of us, I can't remember who it was, gave a sort of shout and started to his feet, pointing up to the gallery behind us. We all turned around, and there, I give you my word of honour, Lester, stood a man leaning over the rail of the gallery, staring down upon us. We all saw him, every one of us. 8 of us, remember. He stood there a full 10 seconds, looking down with horrible glittering eyes at us. He had a long tawny beard, and his hands, that were crossed together before him, were nothing but skin and bone. But it was his face that was so unspeakably dreadful. It was livid. The face of a dead man. How was he dressed? I could not see. He wore some kind of black cloak over his shoulders, I think, but the lower part of his figure was hidden behind the railings. Well, we all stood perfectly speechless for, as I said, about 10 seconds. And then the figure moved, backing slowly into the door of the room behind him, which stood open. It was the door of my bedroom. As soon as he disappeared, our senses seemed to return to us. There was a general rush for the staircase, and, as you may imagine, there was not a corner of the house that was left unsearched. My bedroom especially was ransacked in every part of it. But all in vain. There was not the slightest trace to be found of any living being. You may suppose that not one of us slept that night. We lighted every candle and lamp we could lay hands upon, and sat up till daylight, but nothing more was seen. The next morning at breakfast, Henderson, who seemed very much annoyed by the whole thing, begged us not to speak of it any more. He said that he'd been told before he'd taken the house that it was supposed to be haunted, but not being a believer in such childish follies, he paid little attention to the rumour. He did not, however, want it talked about because of the servants who would be so easily frightened. He was quite certain, he said, that the figure we'd seen last night must have been somebody dressed up to practice a trick upon us, and he recommended us all to bring our guns down loaded after dinner, but meanwhile to forget the startling apparition as far as we could. We, of course, readily agreed to do as he wished, although I do not think that one of us imagined for a moment that any amount of dressing up would be able to stimulate the awful countenance that we all had seen so plainly. It would have taken a Hare or an Arthur Cecil, with all the theatrical appliances known only to those two talented actors, to have made up that face that was literally that of a corpse. Such a person could not be amongst us, actually in the house, without our knowledge. Well, we had another good day shooting, and by degrees the fresh air and exercise and the excitement of the sport obliterated the impression of what we'd seen in some measure from the minds of most of us. That evening we all appeared in the hall after dinner with our loaded guns beside us. But although we sat up till the small hours and looked frequently up at the gallery at the end of the hall, nothing at all disturbed us that night. Two nights thus went by, and nothing further was seen of the gentleman with the tawny beard. What with the good company, the good cheer, and the pheasants, we'd pretty well forgotten all about him. We were sitting as usual upon the third night, with our pipes and our cigars. A pleasant glow from the bright wood fire in the great chimney lighted up the old hall and a shed of genial warmth about us, when suddenly it seemed to me as if there came a cold breath, a chill of air behind me, such as one feels when going down into some damp, cold vault or cellar. A strong shiver shook me from head to foot. Before I even saw it, I knew that it was there. It leant over the railing of the gallery and looked down at us all, just as it had done before. There was no change in the attitude or alteration in the fixed, malignant glare in those stony, lifeless eyes. No movement in the white and bloodless features. Below, amongst the eight of us gathered there, arose a panic of terror. Eight strong, healthy, well-educated 19th-century Englishmen, and yet I am not ashamed to say that we were paralyzed with fear. Then one, more quickly recovering his senses than the rest, caught at his gun that leant against the wide chimney corner and fired. Well, the hall was filled with smoke, but as it cleared away, every one of us could see the figure of our supernatural visitant slowly backing, as he'd done on the previous occasion, into the chamber behind him, with something like a sardonic smile of scornful derision upon his horrible, death-like face. The next morning, it is a singular and remarkable fact that 4 out of the 8 of us received by the morning post, so they stated, letters of importance which called them up to town by the very first train. One man's mother was ill, another had to consult his lawyer, whilst pressing engagements, to which they could assign no definite name, called away the other two. There were left in the house that day but 4 of us. Wells, Bob Harford, our host and myself. Oh, a sort of dogged determination not to be worsted by a scare of this kind kept us still there. The morning light brought a return of common sense and natural courage to us. We could manage to laugh over last night's terrors whilst discussing our bacon and kidneys and hot coffee over the late breakfast in the pleasant morning room, with the sunshine streaming cheerily in through the diamond-paned windows. "Oh, it must be a delusion of our brains," said one. "Our host's champagne," suggested another. "A well-organized hoax," opined a third. "Oh, I will tell you what we'll do," said our host. "Now that those other fellows have gone, and I suppose we don't any of us believe much in those elaborate family reasons which have so unaccountably summoned them away, we 4 will sit up regularly at night, for night after night, and watch this thing, whatever it may be. I do not believe in ghosts. However, this morning I have taken the trouble to go out before breakfast to see the rector of the parish, an old gentleman who's well up in all the traditions of the neighbourhood. I've learned from him the whole of the supposed story of our friend of the tawny beard, which, if you will, I will relate to you." Henderson then proceeded to tell us the tradition concerning the Dennis Varley who murdered his sister, the nun, a story which I will not repeat to you, Lester, as I see you know it already. The clergyman had furthermore told him that the figure of the murdered nun was almost sometimes seen in the same gallery, but this was a very rare occurrence. When both the murderer and his victim are seen together, terrible misfortunes are sure to assail the unfortunate living man who sees them. And if the nun's face is revealed, death within the year is the doom of the ill-fated person who has seen it. "Of course," concluded our host, "I consider all these stories to be absolutely childish. At the same time, I cannot help thinking that some human agency, probably a gang of thieves or housebreakers, is at work, and that we shall probably be able to unearth an organized system of villainy by which the rogues, presuming on the credulity of the persons who've inhabited the place, have been able to plant themselves securely among some secret passages and hidden rooms in the house, and have carried on their depredations undiscovered and unsuspected. Now, Will all of you help me to unravel this mystery? We all promise readily to do so. It is astonishing how brave we felt at 11 o'clock in the morning. What an amount of pluck and courage each man professed himself to be endued with. How lightly we jested about the old boy with the beard, and what jokes we cracked about the murdered nun. Oh, she'd show her face oftener if she was good-looking. No fear of her looking at Bob Harford, he was too ugly. Well, it was Jack Darrant who was the showman of the party. She'd be sure to make straight for him if she could. He was always run after by the women, and so on, till we were all laughing loudly and heartily of our own witticisms. Well, that was 11 o'clock in the morning. At 11 o'clock at night, we could have given a very different report of ourselves. At 11 o'clock at night, each man took up his appointed post in solemn and somewhat depressed silence. The plan of our campaign had been carefully organized by our host. Each man was posted separately, with about 30 yards between them, so that no optical illusion, such as an effect of firelight upon the oak panelling, nor any reflection from the circular mirror above the chimney-piece, should be able to deceive more than one of us. Our host fixed himself in the very centre of the hall, facing the gallery at the end. Wells took up his position halfway up the short, straight flight of steps. Harford was at the top of the stairs upon the gallery itself. I was opposite to him at the further end. In this manner, whenever the figure, ghost or burglar, should appear, it must necessarily be between two of us, and be seen from both the right and the left side. We were prepared to believe that one amongst us might be deceived by his senses or by his imagination, but it was clear that two persons could not see the same object from a different point of view and be simultaneously deluded by any effect of light or any optical hallucination. Each man was provided with a loaded revolver, a brandy and soda, and a sufficient stock of pipes or cigars to last him through the night. We took up our positions at 11 o'clock exactly and waited. At first we were all four very silent and, as I've said before, slightly depressed. But as the hour wore away and nothing was seen or heard, we began to talk to each other. Talking, however, was rather a difficulty. To begin with, we had to shout. Well, at least we in the gallery had to shout to Henderson, down in the hall. And though Harford and Wells could converse quite comfortably, I, not being able to see the latter at all from my end of the gallery, had to pass my remarks to him second-hand through Harford, who amused himself in misstating every intelligent remark that I entrusted him with. Added to which, natural impediments to the flow of the soul, the elements thought fit to create such a hullabaloo without that conversation, was rendered still further a work of difficulty. I never remember such a night in all my life. The rain came down in torrents. The wind howled and shrieked wildly amongst the tall chimneys and the bare elm trees without. Every now and then there was a lull, and then, again and again, a long sobbing moan came swirling round and round the house, for all the world like the cry of a human being in agony. It was a night to make one shudder, and thank heaven for a roof over one's head. We all sat on our separate posts hour after hour, listening to the wind and talking at intervals. But as the time wore on insensibly, we became less and less talkative, and a sort of depression crept over us all. At last we relapsed into a profound silence. Then suddenly, there came upon us that chill blast of air, like a breath from a charnel house, that we had experienced before. And almost simultaneously a hoarse cry broke from Henderson in the body of the hall below, and from Wells halfway up the stairs. Harford and I sprang to our feet, and we saw it too. The dead man was slowly coming up the stairs. He passed silently up with a sort of still, gliding motion, within a few inches of poor Wells, who shrank back, white with terror, against the wall. Henderson rushed wildly up the staircase in pursuit, whilst Harford and I, up on the gallery, fell instinctively back at his approach. He passed between us. We saw the glitter of his sightless eyes, the shriveled skin upon his withered face, the mouth that fell away like the mouth of a corpse beneath his tawny beard. We felt the cold, death-like blast that came with him, and the sickening horror of his terrible presence. Oh, can I ever forget it? With a strong shudder, Jack Durrant buried his face in his hands and seemed too much overcome for some minutes to be able to proceed. "My dear fellow, are you sure?" I said in an awestruck whisper. He lifted his head. "Forgive me, Lester. The whole business has shaken my nerves so thoroughly that I've not been able to yet get over it. But I have not yet told you the worst." "Good heavens, is there worse?" I ejaculated. He nodded. "No sooner," he continued, "had this awful creature passed us than Harford clutched at my arm and pointed to the farther end of the gallery. "Look," he cried hoarsely, "the nun!" There, coming towards us from the opposite direction, was the veiled figure of the nun. There were the long, flowing black and white garments, the gleam of the crucifix at her neck, the jangle of her rosary beads from her waist. But her face was hidden. A sort of desperation seized me. With a violent effort over myself, I went towards this fresh apparition. "It must be a hoax," I said to myself, and there was a half-formed intention in my mind of wrenching aside the flowing draperies and of seeing for myself who and what it was. I strode towards the figure. I stood within half a yard of it. The nun raised her head slowly, and, Lester, I saw her face. There was a moment's silence. "What was it like, Jack?" I asked him presently. He shook his head. "That I can never tell to any living creature." "Was it so horrible?" He nodded assent, shuddering. "And what happened next?" "Oh, I believe I fainted. At all events, I remembered nothing further. They made me go to the vicarage next day. I was so knocked over by it all, I was quite ill. I could not have stayed in the house. I stopped there all yesterday, and I got up to town this morning. I wish to heaven I had taken your advice, old man, and never gone to that horrible house. I wish you had, Jack. I wish you had," I answered fervently. "Do you know that I shall die within the year?" he asked me presently. I tried to poo-poo it. "Oh, my dear fellow, don't take the thing so seriously as all that. Whatever may be the meaning of these horrible apparitions, there can be nothing but an old wives' fable in that saying. Why on earth should you die? You of all people, a good strong fellow with a constitution of iron. You don't look much like dying." "For all that, I shall die. I cannot tell you why I'm so certain, but I know that it will be so," he answered in a low voice. "And some terrible misfortune will happen to Harford. The other two never saw her. It is he and I who are doomed." Well, a year has passed away. Last summer, fashionable society rang for a week or more with the tale of poor Bob Harford's misfortune. The girl whom he was engaged to and to whom he was devotedly attached, young, beautiful, and wealthy, ran away on the eve of her wedding day with a drinking, swindling villain who had been turned out of ever so many clubs and tabooed for ages by every respectable man in town, and who had nothing but a handsome face and a fascinating manner to recommend him, and who, by dint of these, had succeeded in gaining complete ascendancy over the fickle heart of poor Bob's lovely fiancée. As to Harford, he sold out and went off to the backwoods of Canada, and has never been heard of since. And what of Jack Durrant? Poor, handsome Jack, with his tall figure and his bright, happy face, and the merry blue eyes that had wiled Bella Lester's heart away. Alas, far away in southern Africa, poor Jack Darrant lies in an unknown grave, slain by a Zulu assegai on the fatal plain of Isandula. And Bella goes about clad in sable garments, heavy-eyed and stricken with sore grief, a widow in heart, if not in name.
This whole thing started a few years ago when I bought a book from a local resale shop. The book was The Zombie Survival Guide. Now, I know what you're thinking. Here we go, another one of these survivalist nuts. Well, to be honest with you, you'd be right to think that, because I am. I've undergone weapons training and multiple surviving camps, but none of that is why I chose to write this. In the book I mentioned before, there's a part that references a film, the 1965 Lawson footage. This caught my attention and instantly put me on the path that led me here. The internet will tell you it's make-believe, that it doesn't exist and it was just part of a silly book. But what else would they tell you about something they didn't want you to know? It took 2 years of dead ends and dark web searches before I met Martin Lang. I met Martin through a wilderness survival forum on Reddit. He claimed to have the original film. I couldn't convince him to sell it, but he agreed to meet with me and let me watch the film. The only problem was, Martin lived in Telluride, and I was living in Arizona at the time. It's about an 8-hour trip, add in traffic and stops, more like 9 or 10 hours. We agreed to meet on a Saturday. That way neither of us had to miss work. I remember hoping this wasn't going to be another bullshit blank trip, and it wasn't. We met up at some grill on the corner of North Fur and Columbia. Martin was an older guy, early 50s, I guess. Tall, around 6'2", clean-shaven with short, cropped grey hair. It's hard to describe his demeanour. In a word, I would call it paranoid. He never really looks directly at you when he speaks. He's always scanning the area and talking under his breath as if someone might be listening. Dave, it's good to finally meet you in person. Reaching out to shake my hand with a slightly nervous chuckle. Then he got straight to his point. There's a library 4 blocks from here on Pine Street. They have a film room. I'll meet you there in the morning. There's a hotel 1 street over. Get a room, get some rest, and I'll see you in the morning. I had to stop him right there. The way he was acting was starting to freak me out a little bit. I'm starting to wonder if we were in any real danger. Whoa, slow down, man. Is there something wrong? He stopped scanning the area and looked me directly in the eyes and said, "Yes, there is something horribly wrong, but we'll talk about it in the morning." With that, he gave me that same nervous smile, got in his car and drove away. I could have gotten in my car and gone home, but I didn't. Since I was already at the grill, I grabbed a burger and a beer and then headed over to the hotel. I woke up the next morning feeling like a kid on Christmas, like I was about to unwrap the best gift ever. Worst day of my freaking life. When I got to the library, Martin was already there. As soon as I walked into the film room, Martin jumped as if I caught him doing something wrong. He looked at me for a second and then relaxed. "Look, I'm sorry, man, but after I tell you what I know and show you these films, you'll understand. The movies are bullshit. It's way worse than anyone could imagine. There are different stages of the virus. Stage 1 only affects 1 super rare blood type, and even then most people's immune system destroys it. But there are some the virus thrives in. Once they're infected, they lose their mind. Start doing crazy shit like locking their children in cars or walking into malls and shooting everyone in sight. From what I can tell, this virus is responsible for every serial killer and mass shooting since the 1930s. The zombie part is real, but typically the infected party is either captured or killed.
If the infected person is killed and the body isn't disposed of, the virus reanimates the corpse in an attempt to keep itself alive. Then, and only then, the virus can be passed to any blood type through saliva. I couldn't take any more of nerd babble. I had to stop him from going any further. Look, Martin, this sounds like you're writing fan fiction for The Walking Dead. And to be honest, it feels like bullshit to me. Can we just watch the film already, so I can take my notes and get the hell out of here? He looked a little disappointed by my reaction, but then he said something I'll never forget. You'll understand everything real soon. It wasn't so much what he said, but how he said it that stuck in my head. As it turns out, there were actually 4 cans of film, hours and hours of footage, grainy 8mm home movies, chronicling Harry Lawson going insane and killing 3 people, before he was shot and killed by the town sheriff. The body was kept on the scene a little too long, and he reanimated then, infected several others. The part of the Lawson film everyone knows about is only a small part. The family trying to escape on a school bus was a small excerpt from the end of the film. Hours came and went as we sat in the dark watching the film. I must have dozed off at some point because a loud pop sound woke me up. The coppery smell of blood and gunpowder filled my lungs as I turned to see Martin propped up against the far wall, sitting on the floor. His blood and brains now dripping from the ceiling. Before I had a chance to process what I was seeing, the door flew open and 2 police officers came rushing in. I was taken into custody and questioned about Martin and what had happened, but in the end, the security footage proved it was a suicide, and I was able to go home. I was on the highway for about an hour before it hit me. The film! I pulled off the highway and grabbed my phone, then called the Telluride Police Department. I told them I'd purchased the films from Martin, but with the situation being what it was, I'd forgotten to pick them up before leaving. It worked. I got the films and was back on the road in no time. Yes, I know. It was a shitty move. But those films were potentially worth millions. It took a while to line up serious buyers, but when some Asian rich kid from Virginia offered me $2,000 just to watch it, I took the money. That kid went on to gun down 32 people at his college before being killed by the police. My next buyer, some lady from Delaware, she came with 2 other guys. They said they were all film students. After they watched the films, they went home and executed 3 of their classmates before being taken into custody. At this point, all I wanted was to get rid of the films. It was about 4 months before I saw another buyer. The guy seemed normal enough to me. He told me he worked for some mid-range production company, and if the film was legit, they'd make an offer on the rights to the films. Well, the deal never happened. The day after seeing the film, that asshole went out and killed 9 people in a shopping mall somewhere in Nebraska. Because of that, another rep from that same company came by a few weeks later and asked to view the films. This time I said no. I tried to stop it, but after rejecting their deal several times, they offered $500,000 for a copy of the films. And on Christmas Eve, that same rep killed her entire family before committing suicide by hanging herself. That one led to the first mini-outbreak of the virus. I believe that was in Washington, but the CDC and a few other government agencies got that contained and eliminated in no time, blaming the deaths on some horrible strain of the flu. I wouldn't see another customer for a year. Actually, it was the same time of year, Christmas. A businessman from California. He watched the film and bought a copy. He went home and invited a few people over for a Christmas party. There, get this. The guy dressed up as Santa and proceeded to murder everyone at the party before he set the house on fire and committed suicide by cop. Now, this process goes on for years, from 2007 to 2019. But as of a few months ago, I've finally done it. I spent all the money I've made from viewings and copies, spreading the virus to small, isolated areas all over the world. Places where no one could get there in time to stop the incubation period. South America was first to fall. Why do you think all those people walked from Ecuador through Mexico to the border? Wasn't seeking the American dream. They were running for their lives. And soon everyone will be. My name is Dave. And I started the zombie apocalypse. You're welcome.
The hours seem to drag tonight, he mused as he walked numbly but deliberately along the city streets. Most nights, the time flew by quickly on dark wings of some swift and avenging nocturnal predator. A fitting analogy, he noted, comparing speed to something akin to himself and his kind. But this evening was different. The city, its inhabitants, and indeed the very buildings and trees, seemed to be locked in a sort of suspended animation, as if captured in a photograph. Nothing moved for miles. And still, he trudged on. He could sense no sign of life and wondered if his usually keen senses had lost their edge. Worse yet, were they right? He was hungry and desperate. Unlike most of his kind, he was blessed, or perhaps cursed, with the ability to transform himself into other beings, both human and animal, with ease. He could pass for an attractive man, or even transform himself into a very convincing facsimile of a dog or a cat in order to properly get nourishment. In addition to this, he could become invisible. Big deal, he thought. What good did all those things do if no one accepts you? He drew his cloak around him. Not that he really needed a cloak. With his shape-shifting abilities, he was able to withstand cold, heat, and any other conditions thrown in his direction by the forces of nature. What he could not tolerate, however, was the separation and ostracization of the other vampires. Since his entrance into the realm of the undead, it had been decided by the High Council that he be given the ability to shapeshift. But he often wondered why he was counted among those favored few who possessed this strange and coveted trait. He kept his questions to himself, though, for the ways of the council were never to be doubted or questioned in any way, and he had been chosen. So he accepted that gift, along with his immortality, and he used it. The council, of course, were adamant in the adherence to the ancient traditions and strict rules of transfiguration. Only certain forms of animal, other than human, were allowed. For one thing, he could only assume the shape of a predatory animal. Very rarely a reptile, and never a bird or a fish. In addition to that, the animal must always bear large teeth, long canines which were meant to rip and tear the flesh of victims, rather than simply making neat little inconspicuous holes in the necks of the unfortunate prey. Once, long ago, on a journey in the jungles of Central America, he had brought the natives' legends of the fabled chupacabra, or goat sucker, into terrifying reality. True, it enabled him to snare prey more easily than he'd ever known. Yes, it did give him the advantage of human superstitions and irrational fears. But in the end, he was sorry. Word of his transgression reached the High Council. He was therefore summoned to stand trial before them for breaking the ancient laws concerning shapeshifting. He was sure he'd done nothing wrong, or out of the ordinary. However, the council strongly disagreed. Our laws and rules state clearly that no shapeshifter must ever assume the form of anything fabricated in the minds of humans. The goat sucker is every bit a fantasy figure as the dragon, mermaid, or any other thing of legends and fairy tales. They expounded on that taboo, saying that fantasy creatures brought into this world would draw much unwanted attention and make humans aware of a once invisible threat. Realistic animals, dangerous as they may be, were more or less commonplace. But real animals such as a bear or a wolf could draw a considerable amount of attention, especially when a series of attacks sharpened people's interest as well as fear. Several years back, he had stalked the areas of Northern California in the form of a mountain lion, making his way into populated areas, attacking and killing many people. When the park rangers, as well as the police and the media, took special notice of these mysterious mountain lion attacks, he knew he needed to disappear soon and find new hunting territory. For he himself was in danger of being caught. His punishment? Ostracism from all his peers. Even his beloved mentor and maker. He would know now what it was like to be truly alone. Before he was made, he had read where some primitive peoples of various world cultures would banish a member of a tribe if he or she had broken taboo. That person would be considered dead by family, friends, and all who knew him or her. Loneliness would soon sap all will to live from the banished one's heart and mind, and suicide by auto-suggestion would occur. That would not happen in his case, he told himself repeatedly. His will to live was far too strong. Besides this, he concluded in his own mind that the ugly green of jealousy had colored the decision of those who bore witness against him at the trial. No one, not even the High Council, had the right to limit his darkness-given talent. He would prove the victor, despite his circumstances. But first, he must satisfy his hunger. Tonight, though, that would prove a somewhat difficult task. It seemed his usual victims were scarce. Perhaps it was time to try a new approach, maybe even a new source of food. He sniffed the air. He listened for signs of life. His reflective eyes pierced through the fog, trying to see anything new. His empty veins burned. He continued on his way. On this particular night, he hunted in the guise of a man. It had not been the first time, and more often than not, he had been successful. In his human persona, he exhibited an intense, hypnotic charisma, combined with raw sex appeal, which drew his victims to him with little or no effort at all. As well, this was the easiest way to pass through cities and towns inconspicuously. He also had the option of going place to place unseen via his invisibility method, but he rarely used that. It was an exhausting process which left him little strength to hunt and feed. As for animals, he saved those forms for roaming the rural and more sparsely populated areas. Then, on the cool pre-dawn breeze, he sensed it. Prey. Off in the distance, he could hear a woman's voice. Another voice answered it. Two women. Now things would start happening for him. If he thought at least one of them beautiful, he'd remake her into a creature like himself. If he found both of them attractive, all the better. Yet he could never pass on the gift of shape-shifting. That talent was bestowed upon him alone. But at least he assured himself a companion in the long, dark years of immortality. He would not be lonely, and she would live forever at his side, looking upon him as maker, hero, champion, and lover. Moreover, she would know nothing of how he came to be shamed and excluded. She would know what he needed her to know, and that was it, he told himself. He started off in the direction of the two female voices. Well, it was necessary, the first spoke emphatically. An example had to be made, and we... Her voice trailed off at the sound of muffled footsteps. What was she talking about? No matter. He was ready to satisfy himself, and mere words should never distract him. He approached. Both women turned. The woman who spoke was of medium height with long, dark, wavy brown hair. Her posture was straight, and she didn't seem to be the type that would startle easily. In fact, her demeanor was calm, assertive, and full of practical purpose. Her dark blue eyes met his pale ones. She didn't greet him, or was even the least bit surprised that he was there. It was as if she were expecting him to come to her at this particular place at this particular time. Her companion was different, however, and at the sight of the stranger she gasped and gave a sharp little cry. She was a petite little thing, with strawberry blonde hair which had been cut and teased into a sort of faux windblown look which suited her pointed little chin and big, weepy, wet green eyes. She was not only startled, but visibly frightened. She reminded him of a nervous bird ready for flight at a moment's notice. She was right to feel some measure of awe. Here was a man of rather ordinary appearance. Yet beneath the surface, the intense magnetism was about to emerge like a serpent uncoiling itself from a tree. Already, there was tension in the air. His human persona was handsome, but not in the polished, Hollywood leading man sort. There was a starkness and ferocity about him, not to mention the slightly shabby clothes he wore. His face was angular and pale, and his eyes were a soft mist grey which could harden into steel, charcoal, or even black when provoked to attack. For now, they remained soft and misty, reflecting light much the way cat's eyes do. The hair was dark and hung about his head and shoulders wildly, as if it had never been touched by brush or comb, and he strode towards them the way a wolf does when encountering its next meal. His hands were large and bony with long fingernails, which more accurately resembled claws or talons than human fingernails, despite the flesh covering those hands being white, clean, and deceptively silky soft. Yes, even as a man, much of him remained a beast. The brunette smiled when he reached them. She seemed inexplicably pleased to see him, and he wondered if they'd ever met. He couldn't help noticing just how attractive she was with her tall, slim form and luxurious hair. She might make a fit companion for him after all. His hands slackened around the edges of his cloak. Deep in the mountains, in an almost forgotten part of the world, the council had assembled itself. At a massive table in the great hall of the castle, 12 figures discussed at length the transgressions and broken rules of the animal shapeshifter among their kind. He seemed to learn nothing from his punishments. Banishment only made him penitent for a short while, and his will to live was kept afire by pure defiance. What could be done about this? They were stymied for a solution, but certainly not at a loss for words. "He's gotten just what he deserved," snapped a tall, black-haired woman seated along the left-hand side of the table. Her long nails drummed noisily on the dark wood. "It's just what the council ought to have done in the first place." "Has he?" drawled a voice next to her. "Or are you simply jealous because you weren't chosen for such an honor?" The speaker turned his angular features toward the dark beauty. She did not flinch, but looked past him to address the head of the council. "You yourself know what he did was against everything our kind adheres to. He brought this on himself for abusing his power." Her dark eyes flashed in her austere, beautiful face. "Why not send someone to take care of this lawbreaker once and for all?" "Perhaps," began a wheezy voice further down the table, "it is because he is, or rather was, young when he was made. Youth does tend to be irresponsible with powers."
"That has no bearing whatsoever,"
intoned a deep-voiced figure whose hand bore a rather ornate ruby ring.
"Young or old, those who have lived millennia or centuries, all must obey the laws set down for us by the council."
"Oh, really?" snarled a young, slim female dressed in black leather. She brushed aside a wisp of honey blonde hair from her left eye. "And just what makes you so quick to judge? I mean, after all, we're all trying to go our own way and get what we can. Who said anything about rules anyway?"
"Are you on his side?"
drawled the man next to the dark woman. He set his small ice blue eyes upon her. His gaze was steady and chilling.
"What if I am?"
she snorted defiantly. You were all so damned high and mighty. We were never meant to follow rules. Those are for the mortals, not us.
They follow rules,
the deep voice bearer of the ring went on in his deep, sonorous voice.
So must we. A lion must learn the habits and behavior of wildebeest and buffalo. So must we. We need to be as cautious and clever as the humans are, and more. We can't risk scaring them off or exposing ourselves. That would be disastrous.
He rose from his place at the head of the table and raised a big, bony hand. From his black velvet robe, he seemed to produce, as if by magic, a long scepter, at whose end was a solid gold skull adorned with rubies and sapphires. He banged it 3 times on the table, and the council fell into respectful silence. The 12 members of the council all looked up simultaneously into his skull-like face, peering out of a purple-lined black hood. They waited.
For centuries, we have abided by the laws set down to us by our ancestors, and in that time few rules have been broken. Those who have been so foolish or arrogant have suffered the consequences. That has always been a part of our plan. The shapeshifter must take his punishment and be made an example. What he did was unacceptable. And thus, I've sent the appropriate one to execute the correct punishment.
There was some scattered applause at the table, and a triumphant expression on the statuesque face of the beautiful dark woman. The serpentine man with the ice blue eyes and sarcastic drawl simply tented his long hands together and stared at his own skeletal fingers. The wheezy-voiced man coughed noisily into a silk handkerchief. The blonde simply stared at the council leader with undisguised hatred. Once again, the butt of the scepter was struck 3 times, staccato fashion, on the dark table. The bony, ruby-ringed hand commanded silence. Again, he spoke.
I wish to call the maker of the shapeshifter to account, he said, as a pained look crossed his face momentarily.
To everyone's surprise, up rose a tall, statuesque figure in crimson velvet. The beautiful, black-haired woman strode purposefully to the end of the table. But now, all smugness had vanished from her face. She, too, looked pained and hideously ashamed of what she had created. She turned to face the others. She glanced around. After what seemed like an eternity, she began.
When he was first created, I had no idea he would be so rebellious. Perhaps I was the one at fault for putting the idea of shapeshifting into his head. But in my own way, I sensed he had potential to be unique and skillful as one of our kinds, and I also knew that animals possessed certain attributes which humans did not. I wanted him to have those attributes, so I petitioned the High Council to bestow these gifts upon him. And I was proud of him. I was as proud of him as a mother is of a son, or a wife is of her husband. And yes, she addressed the serpentine man, I was jealous. Hot tears welled in her eyes. I wanted to be those animals in every way, but I knew I was not destined or chosen for shapeshifting. So the next best choice was to see someone close to me given those gifts. And so I lived, to use the term loosely, vicariously through my latest creation. The young man had been wounded by a wild animal in the woods by his home and taken to the nearest hospital. And I was there, unknown to the mortal doctors and nurses in the hospital. So I saw the opportunity and I took full advantage. The young man lived, but not in the normal way that they'd all expected. He developed animalistic tendencies, and more tests were done. A few doctors had even suggested that he had contracted rabies, but I knew otherwise. He was becoming what I had always wanted to be. The first night I glimpsed him in his mountain lion form, I was moved to tears. It was magnificent. Her voice broke slightly, and she stopped to wipe her eyes with a handkerchief. At this, the blonde girl rose up and cried, So you don't exactly have the moral ground to...
Silence, the robe leader roared. I must have order. She will be allowed to speak.
As time passed, she continued, he began asking questions about his abilities. Once he studied every animal he was allowed to emulate, he began to experiment with ones of mythical nature, such as that cursed goat sucker from Central America. I was never more humiliated. Drawing attention to mythical creatures such as this one would no doubt inspire suspicion in the human's belief that we, too, exist and are every bit as real as they are. Most of our societal camouflage has come from the fact that mortals see us as little more than legends, the stuff of their horror genre of film or literature. We've hidden behind that lie for centuries. If they do not believe, then they are not aware of us, and thus are easy prey for us. Awareness of us is, in itself, a defense against us. Because of my own vanity, I assumed that my creation would obey me and the rules that I followed. He did not. I hadn't taken into account the notion of free will or individual pursuits. So he was punished by ostracism. No one would have anything to do with him after that. But he survived, and I wished he hadn't. I regretted the moment I ever laid eyes on him. I wanted him punished, but I didn't know how. Very much like a parent who is forever marred by the offspring's misdeeds, I was only too glad to be separated from him permanently. For years, I have denied ever knowing him. I hid in a place in the northern mountains, hoping every once in a while to hear the news of his death. Yet I never heard anything about him being alive either. She paused. Until just a short while ago.
Ah, yes. The leader's white face stared pensively down at the ruby ring on his bony finger. Ah, that was when the reports about the mountain lion attack were all over the humans' media.
That's correct, she nodded. I knew his signature animal and killing style to be that of the North American mountain lion, Puma. I managed to travel halfway around the world and... there he was. Very shortly after that, he started assuming a human disguise. That was a wise move on his part, for the mountain lion was beginning to bring much unwanted attention. The last few nights, I've followed his every step, and now I can see that your method of punishment is appropriate. Do what you need to do.
She nodded respectfully, and he motioned for her to be seated. The collective stare shifted from her downcast face back to that of the stern leader. Then their thoughts turned slowly to the shapeshifter and his whereabouts. They knew his time was drawing to an end. Back on his own familiar territory, the transgressor regarded his intended victims, unaware of the other's judgment and inevitable punishment. He continued to walk toward the two women, his lips drawn back in a feral grin. She said nothing, but continued to stare back at him as if to say, "Here I am, I'm all yours." He stopped. Then some shade of recognition passed over his face. Then he stopped and a jolt of fear passed through him as he saw his intended victim. Something was wrong. But what was it? It was as if an alarm had gone off, warning him of impending danger. She, however, remained rooted to her spot as he took a hesitant step in her direction. One thought burned in his mind at that moment. Never allow fear or any other emotion to distract you. The powerful must always remain in control. Never forget that you and your kind are the supreme ruler. He didn't see what came next. In one flash, a swift, snarling, clawing form was upon him, tossing him to the ground like a rag doll. He looked directly up into the yellow eyes of a raging mountain lion. But how? He was then aware of a searing, slicing pain as the animal's claws tore through him. In his weakened state, he then saw the face of the beast change slowly into that
of the strawberry blonde. How ironic, he mused, drawing his last breath, that he be defeated by another shapeshifter like himself. How strange that someone like that should find him tonight of all nights. His captor once again morphed easily into her animal form, and with her canine teeth grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and severed his spine. Above them, the sky became pale as the stars winked out. Soon, they would be here, and they would need to leave quickly. The transgressor's body could not be disposed of just yet. They would need to bring it back for confirmation to the council that everything had gone as planned, and that everything had run according to plan. The brown-haired woman bent over the body just as the sun rose and drew out a silver knife. With grim efficiency, she plunged it deep into the chest of the errant shapeshifter and pierced his heart. The other woman joined her in human form, and they spoke quickly about returning to the mountains to notify the council that their task had been done. The next moment, the women noticed a dark shape approach them from behind. Then two shapes. The first one was tall and powerful, and moved in his black and purple robes with great strides. The other stood just as tall, in red velvet, but her gait was much more sinuous. The gold scepter the black-robed figure carried glinted in the early sunlight. The ruby on his big, powerful hand shone through the mist like a freshly opened wound. The face of the figure in red was downcast and hidden beneath abundant black hair. The strangers approached the two women. "Well done," proclaimed the leader as he walked along the length of the transgressor's broken body, inspecting it as if it were a freshly tidied room or finished work of art. "I must admit, you were the right one for this assignment." He turned his skeletal face in the direction of the strawberry blonde. "It makes sense that you did the ultimate honors, my dear." His large mouth grinned, displaying rows of large, pristine, white, dagger-like teeth. He regarded the body again. "This is what comes of disobedience. An example has been made." He went back to the statuesque figure in red velvet and whispered something in her ear. When she made no move to approach the body, he took her by the arm and led her down where the distorted remains of her creation lay. She did not cry, neither did she show any anger or remorse. Her chiseled white face wore a look of dead, cold indifference. "We must burn the body," she spoke in a low voice. "But not here. It must be taken to the palace in the mountains, and a pyre must be made, and all of our kind must view it and learn from this beast's errant ways. Disobedience cannot be looked upon lightly." The leader raised his scepter, and the two other women nodded in agreement. The following night, as expected, many had gathered outside the palace grounds, and kindling was piled high in preparation for the burning of the shapeshifter. As others of his kind watched, all who knew him mused over what he had done and reflected their own opinions of the matter. There are those who felt, as the council had, that his punishment was just, while others truly sympathized with his plight and praised his radical, rule-breaking ways as courageous and imaginative. Still, others were uncertain as to what they thought, but all who had been there could have sworn that they heard the snarl of a mountain lion as the last of the funeral fire burned down.
So once again, we reach the end of tonight's podcast. My thanks as always to the authors of those wonderful stories, and to you for taking the time to listen. Now, I'd ask one small favor of you. Wherever you get your podcast from,
please write a few nice words and leave a 5-star review, as it really helps the podcast. That's it for this week, but I'll be back again same time, same place, and I do so hope you'll join me once more. Until next time, sweet dreams and bye-bye.